Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today to get to speak to the author of a very interesting book, in some ways all about New York City, but in many ways about really the entire world beyond it. The book is titled Language City, The Fight to Preserve Endangered Mother Tongues in New York. It's just come out in early 2024, and the author is Ross Perlin. I don't want to give too much more away about what the book is about. So Ross, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Miranda.
Could you please start us off by introducing yourself a little bit and explain why you decided to write this book?
I'm a linguist, writer, and translator, so most recently author of Language City, The Fight to Preserve Endangered Mother Tongues in New York, which we'll talk about. I'm also co-director of the Endangered Language Alliance, a nonprofit since 2010 here in New York that's focused on documenting endangered languages and supporting linguistic diversity. I think we'll also chat about that a little bit. And I teach linguistics at Columbia. And then in terms of, what brought me to write the book, right? That's the that's the question. So it really grows out of all those roles that I just mentioned. It's the work of about a decade. I've been researching endangered languages and involved in language documentation for about 20 years. Did my PhD in linguistics, focused on Himalayan languages. That involved sort of a long-term fieldwork project in southwest China, working on a language called Trung, spoken in one particular valley in southwest China on the border with Myanmar and the Tibetan Autonomous Region. So, you know, this is sort of a subfield of linguistics, which has emerged since the 1990s, sometimes called language documentation, in response to the massive worldwide loss of linguistic diversity, and focused on the responsibility of linguists working together with communities and language activists to document the many endangered languages, which really there's very little material for. So my fieldwork was focused on producing a dictionary in collaboration with the community there, a grammatical description of Trung, as well as a corpus of texts which are archived, transcribed, and translated, and so on, and are sort of showing the language in action. So, you know, kind of fast forwarding to how this kind of comes to New York, I return back to New York City, where I'm from, and the Endangered Language Alliance, this organization, has just been established to do this kind of work, but in cities, sort of flipping the traditional ideas of field work that, you know, it's about going to a remote mountain or island always, and actually sort of seeing that because of urbanization and a whole set of factors, increasingly speakers of endangered languages are coming to cities like New York, and not only New York, as we can talk about. So, you know, I throw myself into this. I kind of see that this is, you know, in some ways a kind of a new way of doing field work, and that it sort of is a new kind of story about languages and cities, I think more generally, urban linguistic diversity. While it's something that everybody is in some ways aware of, You know, that cities are very diverse in a general sense, at least with sort of larger and national languages. I think there's been very little awareness of just to what extent smaller, endangered, and indigenous and minority languages are also very much the sort of engine of urban history as well, and perhaps now some more than ever. So in brief, then we can go into more detail. The book is both a linguistic history of New York City, which I think is today, as I say, as far as we know, the most linguistically diverse city, perhaps not just in the world, but in the history of the world. So the past, present, and future of that, as well as the story of this organization, the Endangered Language Alliance, and portraits of six speakers of endangered languages from different parts of the world and the ways in which they are working on behalf of their languages.
And all three of those things are things I'm going to ask you about in more detail. So thank you for the lovely kind of overview that sets us up nicely. Starting with the Endangered Language Alliance, because we've mentioned it a few times, can you tell us more about this organization, both kind of big picture, what its goals are, but also maybe sort of what's a normal Tuesday like? Like what does the on the ground aspect involve?
Tuesdays are very interesting, but so are Wednesdays and Thursdays and all the days. It's a unique and you know, shoestring and extraordinary kind of operation that was founded in 2010 by a combination of linguists and poets and language activists and language lovers in New York. I at the time actually was still in Southwest China. I came back a few years later. Have been co-director since 2013. And we're right in the middle of Manhattan. We're a completely, you know, independent nonprofit, and it's sort of an extended family, and in some ways, almost like a kind of a clubhouse for people who care about language in the city. And of course, that work also extends beyond New York as well. This is our focus in many ways, and allows us to do, you know, a lot right here locally, but also, as I show in Language City, it connects us to, you know, I've gone with members of communities here in New York, sort of back to their home regions in Nepal, Tajikistan, and elsewhere. So it also can include field work, you know, on the other side of the world, with, you know, communities that people here are connected to. You know, I try to paint a portrait of a day in the life in this organization in the book. It's you know, we do a huge range of things. You know, a lot of it is kind of catch as catch can. It's in response to community needs and community interests. Some of it is, you know, more academic, linguistic documentation work of the kind that I was doing in China, working on dictionaries, grammars, recording languages, which have, you know, seldom, if ever, been recorded. You know, some of it is much more public facing and has to do with language policy, working with city agencies here in New York, language access and then interpretation and translation, public events that bring languages that have not been kind of on stage before to a wider audience, whether it's poets or musicians or others who are working in those languages here, giving them a platform, classes, holding classes in languages that are not usually taught. So there's kind of a menu of options and ideas that that we have available. And of course, a lot depends on time and funding and people and energy. But when people approach us and say, oh, I want to do something about my language, I want to record my grandmother in Queens, oh, I want to do something in, you know, in my village back in, you know, Guinea or Nepal or Mexico. And we try in various ways to kind of equip them to do so, work with them, support them as this kind of, you know, extended family of linguists, language activists, and others.
Mm. And we're going to get into, I think they're going to come up as we continue to talk. But that gives us a very helpful idea of sort of what the organization is. And as I said, I think we'll get into some more examples of the work that you do. But in order to give us sort of further context for this, I think you're right, right? A lot of people think about New York as being a very multicultural place, as being a place where people come from all over. But how diverse really is the language landscape in New York City? Because it's really quite more than I think a lot of people think. So can you give us a brief introduction to that point? And then I think we'll discuss how that came to be.
I should start by saying that I think many people are not aware of the depth of linguistic diversity globally, right? That linguists now talk about over 7,000 languages in the world, of which as many as half are considered endangered. And that I find exceeds what even otherwise, well-informed worldly people think in terms of the world's languages. Most people have not, heard of many languages that are not national standard languages. So, with that depth of diversity, those who are aware of it then get, as I said, kind of associated with sort of remote locations or, oh, that must be some village on the other side of the world. And part of what we're trying to substantiate and communicate, just as we've sort of come upon it and learned about it, is the extent to which actually all communities now are on the move. All communities are urbanizing and going into diaspora. Urbanization, is such a major feature of our time. So what distinguishes New York, I think, is that this is perhaps the place where it's been going on for longest, where, as I describe in the book, in terms of the city's linguistic history, you have this Lenape-speaking archipelago, and Lenape, the original language of the whole region that today's New York City is a part of, is part of the book. It's one of the major stories I tell in the book. But then you have the Dutch West India Company setting up this multilingual port from the very beginning. It wasn't actually a project of the Dutch state exactly. It wasn't anything like the other 12 kind of English-speaking colonies that were set up in North America at that time. We're in sort of the 400th anniversary of the colonial founding of the city by a group of Walloon-speaking religious refugees, Walloon being a minority language of the French-Belgian border. That's where those settlers came from. And from the very beginning was sort of defined by the presence of speakers of languages whose names most people would not necessarily recognize from, three continents, Native American languages, as well as European minority languages, as well as languages of West Africa brought by enslaved Africans. That has now, there's been four centuries of those processes. And we have been, in the last decade or so at the Endangered Language Alliance, mapping the linguistic diversity of New York and have found, over 700 language varieties and counting, not even sort of getting deep into the question of dialects and other little more local varieties, but so over 10% of the world's linguistic diversity represented here, including certainly all the major, national languages that are well known, but also so many of those indigenous and endangered and smaller languages as well. That's something like five times the number that are registered by the U.S. Census Bureau, which, like most data or census data from any country I've looked at, with a few exceptions, is really inadequate when it comes to capturing linguistic diversity for various reasons. The data around language is notoriously bad for various reasons, especially when it comes to deep linguistic diversity. And so New York is an extraordinary case, I think, that has sort of grown up, and intensified, especially in the last several decades, even though it has sort of several centuries behind it. But New York is not alone either. And, the book more broadly is about languages and cities and sort of connecting the dots with urban linguistic diversity more generally. And I think similar, but different and, extraordinarily different books about London, Los Angeles, Jakarta, Johannesburg, Paris, and many other cities could also be written.
Maybe someone will. That would certainly be quite interesting to read. In that answer, you very helpfully explained kind of where we're at now and some of the origins. Can you maybe fill in a bit of the history of how we got from there to here?
In terms of the New York City's linguistic diversity in particular?
Exactly.
So I really kind of try to pack a lot of detail into about 100 pages in the book, telling a sort of linguistic history of the city. And I looked for models of this. I think linguists and historians don't usually sort of mix, I guess. And, I was looking for other models of linguistic histories of cities that were not just focused on a few major languages, but actually center lesser known languages. And I found very little. You have this, as I said, Lenape speaking world, which is really displaced and driven out. And Lenape ceases to really be spoken in the city, a few centuries ago, and miraculously survives, but hundreds of miles away, as I describe in the book, with really now a sort of last native speaker actually in Ontario, Canada, and a group of revivalists who are mostly there, or in Oklahoma, which are the sort of two centers where Lenape tribes have established themselves after all those displacements. And then in the city itself, you have, you know, kind of initially this period where Dutch becomes a lingua franca, connecting a very diverse population. So probably, you know, during that period when this was New Amsterdam, it actually was never even majority Dutch mother tongue, but Dutch becomes a lingua franca in the way that English, of course, becomes a lingua franca as well. But New Amsterdam is never really entirely Dutch. There are a reported 18 languages spoken by the first 400 to 500 inhabitants just within the first few decades. Then you have the English take over in 1664, becomes New York. But at the same time, it never becomes sort of entirely English. And Dutch actually persists in pretty extraordinary ways, yielding some famous words into English, such as boss and cookie and so on, but also kind of other extraordinary legacies at a deeper level, I think. But at the same time, immigration is a constant, and the role of the city in many ways is to be this kind of membrane, this kind of middle space between, at that point, especially Europe, and to some extent the Caribbean and Africa, and the Americas. You know, even with American independence, you know, the Revolutionary War, fundamentally, you know, perhaps this is the period where varieties of English are most dominant in the city, but still probably at any given time, as much as half the population as it is today speaks a language other than English at home. And then through the 19th century, this, you know, the waves of migration kind of intensify, given new routes, steamboat technologies. First, the establishment of Castle Garden, which is the first kind of so-called emigrant depot in North America. And then, of course, Ellis Island. And these bring, you know, large communities of Irish speakers, as well as speakers of Germanic varieties, and then ultimately of every European language, essentially. And the minority languages actually of Europe even sort of more represented. So when people think of, you know, New York as a major center of Italian life outside of Italy, it's actually not a place where people are speaking standard Italian. It's a place where people are speaking varieties of Sicilian and various southern, you know, village or town-based varieties, which are extraordinarily diverse unto themselves. The, you know, world of Spanish New York is actually heavily Galician-speaking. The world of French New York is Breton-speaking to a substantial extent. So in each case, I try to trace these, you know, what's sort of going on underneath the kind of national category that people often sort of put, often kind of anachronistically, onto immigration history, and see that actually, if you look at where people are coming from specifically, and the things that are happening kind of internally in the communities, there's you know, this very strong representation of indigenous and endangered and minority languages. And then this process through the 20th century really kind of becomes global, with, you know, certainly these sort of cycles of immigration policy, which are an important part of the story as well. So, you know, even though New York is kind of hugely benefiting from and growing into at that point, the largest city in the world, the biggest port in the world, on the strength of immigration, really, in many ways, there's a huge backlash in the country leading to this 1924 immigration law, which tries to kind of close the door. We're right in the 100th anniversary of that today, and perhaps, you know, we're now at a moment where that could be repeated, of course, which is something that I also get to. But you know, then there are these cycles, but fundamentally, there is this kind of these widening kind of waves of migration, and then in 1965, the door is kind of reopened in some sense. And, you know, I trace this history kind of through four chapters, one called Minority Port, which is looking at the early period, one called Survivor City, which is about the particular kind of role that New York has played as a home for exiled peoples who are, you know, survivors of genocides, of displacements, of enslavement. And this covers a variety of, you know, situations, people fleeing, African-Americans fleeing and Gullah Geechee speakers fleeing the Jim Crow South, as well as those fleeing the late Ottoman genocides, as well as those fleeing the Holocaust. I have a chapter called Indigenous Metropolis, which looks at how New York became this sort of center of for Indigenous peoples of the Americas. So even though Lenape speakers are driven out over the course of the 20th century, more and more other Native American groups, individuals start to come, most famously the Mohawk iron workers who helped build so much of the skyline that we associate with New York and actually form a community in Brooklyn. That's a whole amazing story unto itself. This was a Mohawk-speaking world right in the middle of Brooklyn for much of the 20th century. And then now increasingly speakers of indigenous languages from Central and South America who have built large communities. So that's a more recent but also huge development. And then finally, I have a chapter called this is all just kind of in the historical section called Global Microcosm, which looks at after the 1965 Immigration Act, how you have the emergence of these of a whole new Caribbean New York, Latin American New York, Asian New York, and African New York. With the sort of and people are coming, of course, by particular routes from particular places. So it's not, again, that everybody and everything is represented. It's particular stories, but you do have then, you know, in certain parts of the city, like Brighton Beach, Brooklyn, you have the emergence of a microcosm of Soviet linguistic diversity, even after the Soviet Union has ended. In Harlem and the Bronx, you have a microcosm of the African diaspora, and especially of West African languages. And so on. So, you know, that kind of brings it up to the present day, which, again, it's not just to say, oh, wow, everything is here, but that there are these sort of particular stories, but that it's become a kind of, as I say, the most linguistically diverse city, it seems, that at least has been documented, you know, in history.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
No, absolutely. That gives us a very good picture of just how diverse it is and how it got there. I think it's, I'm to some extent, obviously, what you've described already could be a book in and of itself, right? The linguistic history of New York, as you have it in the book, is very interesting. One could probably stop there if one wanted to. But I think the inclusion of the fact that you continued in the book kind of gives us an even deeper picture of just how diverse the city is, and of course how diverse languages can be. It takes us really away from these false dichotomies of being monolingual or bilingual, or actually there's a lot of other things that could be happening, that is exemplified by the fact that you focus a lot of the book on six people. So we really can go into detail about, like, okay, what does this look like on a human level? So could you please introduce us to those six people briefly and explain how you chose those six?
Yes. So I think, you know, this is in many ways the core of the book. I think, you know, there are kind of two books inside here, but I think, and I hope that they're complementary. And these are all, you know, these are six speakers who are of our time, coming from different parts of the world, representing very different languages, communities, and situations. And I hope they sort of bring this story to life in a distinctive way. And I should say that they themselves in total, you know, speak over 30 different languages. I'm focused kind of on their mother tongues, but I also talk about their multilingualism. There's also a lot about language contact, the sort of new mixed languages or forms of language mixing that are sort of crucial in cities. So I hope to sort of that these stories kind of bring bring it alive the way it's actually experienced in day-to-day life. And you get to know people who, you know, are in extraordinary ways kind of language activists and working on this. So maybe to sort of, just to go in order of how I present them, there is, I think, what is really a sort of a case that brings this alive, where I've been working kind of intensively with the speaker for many years. I talk about this language called Seke. I focus on a woman named Rasmina, who in her mid-20s is the one of the very youngest speakers of this language, which comes from 5 villages of Nepal, close to the border with Tibet. This is a language, you know, in that sort of broader Tibetan or sometimes called Trans-Himalayan language family that I also had worked on in China. And it's really kind of representative of this new Himalayan diaspora world, which with its dozens of languages has come to New York, and especially to Queens and Brooklyn, which is where indeed so much of this story unfolds, kind of a little bit outside of the, again, the world of the skyscrapers and Manhattan that we usually think of. Actually, much of the linguistic diversity of the city today is, and this is true in other cities as well, it's actually in sort of lesser known neighborhoods a little away from the center for various reasons. So in the case of Seke, you have as much as, you know, a quarter to a third of the speakers having come to really just a few buildings, even in Brooklyn and Queens, what I call vertical villages. And Rasmina has lived in one of them. And, you know, we sort of trace what it means for a language that, you know, where intergenerational transmission is already being broken for various reasons. I mean, the spread of Nepali as a national language, other surrounding languages just in that particular area of Nepal that are exerting some pressure on Seke. This is a completely oral language, like so many of the languages we're talking about here. So I sort of try to get into what it means to document a language, what it means to try to write down a language. I get into some of the grammar and the linguistic structures and some of the real kind of issues linguistically in this work. With both Rasmina and the other 5 who I'll detail in a second, I should say that really, you know, there are many people who could have been included here, but these are people that I know well, that we've worked with for years, generally through the Endangered Language Alliance. And, to some extent, I tried to choose as being in some ways representative of different, you know, different parts of the world, different linguistic situations, different approaches to language maintenance and documentation and revitalization. So I talk next about Husnia, a speaker of Wahi, also from high mountain Asia, actually from Tajikistan, but in many ways a very different situation, a deeply multilingual person who has learned a different and used a different language at every kind of level of her life. Depending on how one counts, it's almost kind of hard to say what it means, but like a dozen different languages, kind of coming from a post-Soviet, also sort of Silk Road or New Silk Road world, this town Murghab, up on the border of Tajikistan and China, speaking this language Wahi, which is part of this Pamiri community, which is religiously from the Ismaili movement within Shia Islam, but a very distinctive kind of religious movement, and is really kind of one of the newest diasporas, certainly here in the city, a very small new Pamiri community speaking half a dozen languages. She's somebody who is especially kind of focused on children, the first kind of Pamiri children being born in New York and thus the U.S., and creating children's books for them. That's one of the projects that I talk about. And, just what it means for all these identities as a, you know, as somebody who's Ismaili, as somebody who was born still basically in the Soviet Union and is Central Asian and is, you know, sort of at the intersection of so many different situations linguistically and culturally. Then I talk about Yiddish, which is a larger language, which in some ways is becoming kind of unendangered in the middle of New York through the revitalization of the Hasidic community, where Yiddish remains a spoken language and is growing. But I profile a man named Boris, who is novelist, one of the few people who's still kind of producing literature at a rapid pace in Yiddish, was born in Moldova, lived, you know, in the Soviet Union through the sort of the end of Soviet Moldova, certainly the Jewish community, and then, you know, became a sort of central figure in the struggling secular Yiddish cultural life in New York, but sort of has been seeing this quite different Hasidic revival, which is now bringing Yiddish into sort of the fourth and fifth generation here, which is very, very unusual given the way that language loss usually proceeds in the city. So, you know, that sort of allows for a number of different looks at issues around both literature and religion and, you know, the sort of post-Soviet world of Brighton Beach and that part of Brooklyn, which, you know, is also kind of an extraordinary hub of Jewish diaspora languages, which are all struggling as well. And then I talk about a very different situation in a very different part of the city, a writing system called Unko, which is being brought to New York by Ibrahima, who's originally from Guinea. And this is a writing system which is meant to unite the speakers of the Manding languages of West Africa, which is a whole kind of language group. And this writing system was created by a man named Suleiman Akante in the 1940s, one of 20 plus new writing systems which have come out of West Africa in just the last two centuries, kind of speaking to you know, this desire for, as Ibrahima puts it, an African writing system for African languages that can sort of challenge the colonial borders as well as kind of colonial language policies which have divided Manding speakers and you know, led to led to language loss. So he's very focused on technology as well. So I talk about, you know, how Ibrahima and other Unko activists not only are sort of teaching the language for the first time in this emerging West African hub in Harlem and the Bronx, but also getting this unique writing system into Unicode and other technological platforms. So kind of getting to that question of what the role of technology is here, which is a massive one. And then, you know, I talk about Irwin, a chef, a Nahuatl speaking chef from Puebla in Mexico, and Nahuatl having been the language of the Aztecs and a language which is central to Mexican identity. And, you know, certainly to Mexican cooking, as he says, you know, he cooks with these etymologies in mind. Words like taco, guacamole, as well as tomato and chocolate and so on are all Nahuatl words. Thousands of Nahuatl speakers have been coming to New York as part of this kind of new indigenous metropolis. Irwin seeks to keep the language alive through food. Finally, Lenape, which is, as we discussed briefly, you know, the indigenous language of New York, displaced, in some ways the inverse of the rest of the story. But I profile, for the most part, Karen, passed away while the book was being finished, and is from this area in Ontario, in Canada, hundreds of miles from New York City, where the language has survived longest. But was really the first person to bring it back and teach it at our center in the middle of Manhattan, Manhattan itself being a Lenape word whose etymology is contested. You know, those are the six stories. That's just, you know, in brief, but I hope your people are able to sort of dive in and see, I mean, the sort of the richness of people's lives, their linguistic lives, their interactions. And, you know, through the profiles to also glimpse kind of the things about the communities and to bring the languages themselves within earshot with, you know, with a good amount of language in the book itself, translation into English, of course, but in that itself in italics, actually, and the original language sort of given pride of place.
Thank you for that wonderful overview, I suppose. I think we're both sat here going, oh, that doesn't quite do the book justice in terms of all the richness of the detail. But it does, I think, give people hints that might entice them to read it fully. In that overview, something I noticed particularly is the ways in which you very helpfully signaled kind of how each person that you focus on each speaker, in a lot of ways, takes us into a different angle on this work of preserving languages. I did notice, however, some common themes amongst them that I wonder if maybe you could speak to a little bit. One of them was about kind of the ways in which so many of the speakers got into language activism work, not necessarily kind of saying, this is definitely what I want to do. It's sort of a process of realizing, oh, wait, hang on, there's this, and this could help. And in some ways, often you talk about how in the different speakers, it changed the speaker's own relationship with their language or languages. Can you maybe talk about that process and development?
There are both, I think, commonalities and differences here across all six speakers, which are really interesting to tease out. And I should say in general that, you know, we're obviously there's now more and more awareness that we're in an age of language loss and that this is part of what is prompting all of this work. But we're also in some ways in a kind of golden age of language revitalization. And there's all kinds of exciting experiments happening around the world, everywhere from, you know, here in North America, where in many cases Native American tribes are leading the way, to, you know, in New Zealand or Wales or Catalonia, Hawaii. I mean, there's all kinds of interesting experiments happening in terms of different strategies for language revitalization. And part of the book is kind of seeing, yeah, as you say, the different ways that the different speakers here are approaching that, whether it's through kind of, you know, teaching or children's books or cooking and so on. But it's also a very deeply personal process. And I think that is, as you say, a kind of key commonality, that people have to kind of rediscover the language in themselves and revalue it in themselves before, you know, they can be spreading it to others or trying to take on this work, which generally, I should say, this is, you know, we try to pay people to whatever extent we can for work at the Endangered Language Alliance, but a lot of what people are doing is essentially on top of their jobs as, you know, nurses, as servers in restaurants, as short order cooks, as Uber drivers, all these things. So, you know, that revaluing is a big part of, I think, what's happening now kind of globally, which is that really, a major factor in language endangerment has been the kind of internalized shame that people have been made to feel about speaking oral languages, non-standard languages, languages without any kind of official support that they've been told are in some way or another broken or not useful or otherwise inferior, which makes no sense, as I talk about, from any linguistic point of view in terms of linguistic features or structures. Certainly, you know, words can be borrowed for new or coined for new technological items, but in terms of the grammar, sound system, structure of any language spoken natively is equally sophisticated as any other, really. So, you know, undoing the sense of shame and the sort of negative language attitudes, which were really kind of pushed in so many ways on people in very different environments, and which, you know, are still out there in many places. Of course, there are places where it's even kind of illegal to use certain languages. But often it's that, you know, transmission faltering because people at this point, even if they could use the language, have been made to feel that they shouldn't pass it on. And then those pressures kind of accelerating in some ways with migration, coming to New York, the pressure not only to learn English, but also other major lingua francas, as I talk about in the book, whether it's Russian or Spanish and so on, these other languages which have key roles in different parts of the city. And the speakers I'm talking about are embedded, doubly or triply embedded in other communities as well. So, you know, national or pan-ethnic communities where they are in the city. So, yeah, I think it's in each case sort of a process of them kind of seeing that their language has value and is equally rich, and if not, you know, sort of more urgent to preserve, to document, to grapple with, to understand, and that sort of the act of maintaining and, you know, developing a language actually begins in one's own head.
Yeah, I found that a really interesting and important commonality across them. I wonder if we can then talk about kind of what happens next. So if these speakers, you know, in these positions of being in a minority language, perhaps multiple times over, realizing the value of the language, deciding to do something about it. You have given us some brief mentions of ways in which some of these speakers are looking to increase or strengthen engagement with their languages within New York City and beyond. I wonder if maybe we can talk about a few of those in more detail.
It really depends on the situation that the language is in, right? And what kinds of things exist for the speaker. So, you know, most of the speakers I talk about, I mean, in different ways kind of came to us at the Endangered Language Alliance, or we met them through just the course of being, you know, neighbors and people in the same city, or shared communities to do something. So it's, you know, Irwin kind of reading in the newspaper about the Endangered Language Alliance and coming to us and saying, you know, he had just had a kid, he just had a son, and his grandfather had just, who he learned Nahuatl from, had just passed away in Mexico. He hadn't been able to see him since migrating, being undocumented, not being able to go back. But with the birth of his son, wanting to teach the language, wanting to write in the language, and kind of not knowing where to start, being in his case, you know, feeling very isolated, even though there were many other, and there are many other Nahuatl speakers around, for various reasons, they're not kind of concentrated, or we're not finding each other. So we also became a space where people could sort of meet different speakers. I mean, speakers of different indigenous Mexican languages, languages from all over, meeting in our space and kind of exchanging ideas. But, you know, just in his case, for instance, kind of coming to us and saying, well, how do I start with this? I have some knowledge of the language, but I haven't used it in years. And, you know, that's where we can help to some extent by connecting him with, you know, we helped with sort of resources. Okay, here are the ways that people are writing this. Here are some of the work that linguists have done. Here are some other people that we know of in different parts of the world who are working on this. And let's do some events together. Let's hold a class. Let's talk about, you know, the writing system and what the best way to represent the language is. And then as we became involved in projects, you know, around poetry, around language and health and so on, you know, around language and food, livelihood, also kind of continuing to develop and continually finding ways to sort of widen the circle and to draw on Irwin's knowledge and kind of develop it and share it. So, you know, that's kind of one example, but it looks very different in the case of Resmina, for instance, where, as I said, the language Seke, unlike Nahuatl, which is relatively well documented and does have, you know, over 1.5 million speakers at least, although of very different varieties. In the case of Seke, we're starting really from scratch. And I talk there about how, you know, the first step was kind of getting some funding inadvertently, not inadvertently, but through Columbia, where I teach, to do what they call a linguistic field methods class, where I could involve a whole group of students, have Columbia then sort of paying Resmina and sort of launching us into, as a linguistic field methods class does, like the documentation of a language, starting with the very kind of basic questions of, okay, what is the sound system here? Working through what linguists call minimal pairs, which are, words that differ just by a single sound. And then therefore, if there are different meanings between those two, you know that the sounds that differ are meaningful sounds, what we call phonemes. And then that's how you kind of build up a picture of the sound system and see, okay, these are the, you know, bilabial stops, or these are the velar consonants, and, you know, this is the vowel system and all of that kind of more technical phonetic work. And then building up from there into the syntax and the morphology and, you know, working first with her, but then also kind of involving other speakers and, you know, doing multi-sided field work. As I said, going back, we've now gone twice together to Nepal to work with speakers there, since there are certain things that have to be documented in situ, in the traditional homeland where that's possible, while other things are, you know, are good to do in a diaspora setting like New York. So, you know, it really has ranged, as I describe in the book, depending on kind of the situation, but, we try to present those options. We try to kind of be a clearinghouse and, bring whatever linguistic knowledge there is just develop these projects in open-ended ways, depending on what the speakers in the communities themselves are interested in doing and finding to be impactful.
Can you talk a bit more about one of the types of efforts, specifically children's storybooks? Because that comes up more than once. Can you talk maybe about kind of why this is coming up for more languages and to what extent creating a storybook for children, is that similar depending even across different languages, or is it really quite different depending on the language?
When we talk about language endangerment, transmission to the next generation is really the key metric, which is not to say that in most cases that we have such clear data about that, but that's really what people are focused on. And I think it makes a lot of sense because certainly speaker numbers do matter. But if there is stable transmission, if people are able to, teach their children, their grandchildren, that really is the sort of, that's the key. And one of the big issues today is materials for doing so. And, schools have some role to play in this, although it's rare that any of the kinds of languages we're talking about are really going to be able to be taught in schools, certainly here, but even in the home areas. Children's books, we take for granted that there are entire bookstores full of them for languages like English, but actually, in many cases, children's books are not available at all in many languages. I mean, many of the languages we're talking about, there are no books at all available. These are primarily historically oral languages. So, books are few and far between, even about the languages, let alone in them. But for children's books, there is a particular kind of urgency here. And, that has to do with transmission. And the case that I kind of describe in most detail in the book is about Husnia, the Wahi speaker from Tajikistan, who herself has studied early childhood development and was really focused on the first children in this diaspora community being born here. And what will they have to read? Leaving aside all of the studies and discussions about the importance of, language and childhood development and mother tongue education in particular, and kind of hearing, getting enough linguistic input, and of course the benefits of bilingual education. So all these storybooks that we worked on are all bilingual. We've done children's books in other languages, but with Husnia, in the process I describe in the book, we took several years and we did them in the six different Pamiri languages that are represented here and that are the principal languages in that that area in southeastern Tajikistan. And there are just so many interesting questions that you don't even necessarily think about if you're would be doing this in a majority language. So, they're bilingual. They do have English as well as, each of the Pamiri languages. There are six separate books, each with two stories. So then there's one book that's Wahi English, one book that's Shugni English, and so on. Two writing systems for each Pamiri language, because there is not yet a kind of standard single writing system that's used. And given the sort of transnational nature of the communities, having both a Cyrillic based and a Latin based writing system is pretty important, as Husnia and others deemed. The nature of the illustrations, right? I mean, this is crucial in terms of like creating materials that actually are compelling for kids in a world where they have phones around, TV, all kinds of very compelling high tech content just on tap, kind of flowing at all times in larger languages. How do you provide something that is both, feels culturally and linguistically right, but is also modern and compelling and interesting and can sort of demonstrate that, oh yeah, our language is also modern. We have things, we have compelling things for kids to read, and that kids will kind of be drawn to. And of course, all of this we're sort of self-publishing and then figuring out how to distribute it. And it's not necessarily going to be an economical proposition because relatively small speaker groups. and all the sensitivities about what, you know, what variety of the language are you using? What stories are you choosing? To what extent is it traditional? To what extent is it not traditional? I mean, it's just a fascinating set of discussions and things to think about from the, you know, linguistic level to the publishing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Thank you for taking us through that journey in some senses. I wonder if we can maybe talk a little bit about kind of the role of technology in all of this. Obviously, there is the fact that, as you said, kids have shiny access to media and through technology and all sorts of languages, especially dominant ones. Were there ways in which the speakers in the book were able to use technology for their language efforts?
So the place in Language City where I focus on this most is in the section about Ibrahima, the promoter and teacher of Unko, the West African writing system, who, as I said, has been tireless now for well over a decade in terms of making sure that every new technology, as much as possible, he's at least kind of, you know, lobbying and experimenting and trying to find ways to make sure that they support this writing system, which has been an extraordinary success since it was created in the 1940s, that without really any official support, it has just been spreading at a grassroots level across, you know, across borders through West Africa and now into places like New York. So, I mean, I should say also, first off, that the work of language documentation, which I'm describing, has also relied a lot on technology and emerges in the 1990s, partly, of course, in response to this, you know, a wider indigenous rights movement, as well as a recognition of global language loss parallel in certain ways to the loss of biodiversity, but at the same time also crucially involves, you know, the new presence at that time of relatively inexpensive video and audio recording technology, new types of software, the personal computer, the internet for disseminating and archiving materials. So all of those things kind of changed the way that linguists are able to work and are deeply woven into what we do at the Endangered Language Alliance and what I describe in the book. So, you know, before that, really, it was, yes, there were sort of tape recorders and linguists would go out and they would, you know, they would archive those materials in some way, but it was nothing like today in terms of being able to, you know, document and disseminate language materials. So technology has been transformative, and that, you know, continues to be the case in terms of our work. So there's certainly, as with so many things, I mean, there are two sides to it. And, you know, I'm always being asked now about AI and AR and VR and how those are going to change what's happening with, of course, like automatic translation, the Google Translate and other such technologies. Are they going to, you know, create a kind of universal translation situation? Are they going to, how are they going to change the sort of linguistic afterlives of the materials that we're recording? I think, you know, in the view of language activists like Ibrahima, certainly the goal is to try to embrace those technologies, use them, and see them as kind of domains for the language, right? So we think also with endangerment in terms of what domains is a language used in. The home is still often a fundamental one. There's also kind of the village or the town or the neighborhood. There's, of course, you know, schools, religious settings, like each domain, the more domains a language is able to be present in and active in, the more it's, you know, it's vital. And technological spaces, whether it's, you know, social media or YouTube or any such platform, you know, are also such domains. But I talk in the book about how, you know, it really depends on the particular affordances of each medium and each technology and whether it's, you know, how receptive it is to orality. So, you know, Seke speakers who are using voice messages as a way to, you know, continue using their language digitally, the phone and voice messages by being oral, kind of bypass some of these challenges around literacy for speakers of oral languages. At the same time, you know, things like Unicode, which is the way of making sure that every type of character, every type of written symbol is digitally representable are also really important. So I think that there's a huge range of ideas and attitudes among the speakers and language activists in the book about where they see technology going, but I don't think any of them think it's a silver bullet. And definitely, you know, I talk about language as an index time of time spent with people. And this is, I think, particularly kind of the case for smaller language groups, where it's really a marker of belonging and presence. And that, I don't think, is going to change no matter what happens technologically.
Probably not. Can I ask you a few sort of big picture questions, I suppose, about the book overall? Starting with you, obviously this is work you've been engaged with for quite a long time, but was there anything in the process of researching or putting together writing this book that surprised you?
I've been continually surprised through the my whole kind of evolution as a linguist, from, you know, surprise at the depth of New York's linguistic diversity, which really drove the writing of the book, to my, you know, surprise each, you know, almost every week I get some kind of, you know, email or we get a phone call from somebody saying, you know, oh, what about our language, you know, even in the New York area or a particular variety. So we're still kind of updating the language map. We're still learning about different communities. You know, I think we're also seeing just huge changes in, you know, the sort of like valence and kind of larger meaning of the work. So, I really, even though I had been doing this research and just engaged in all of this for much longer, it was during, you know, the height of the pandemic here in New York, when actually the most multilingual immigrant neighborhoods in the city were the epicenter of the epicenter for a number of reasons, such that, you know, many of the people who are talked about in the book were essential workers. They were the people who were actually, you know, the nurses, the cooks, the people who were keeping things running, and in severely overcrowded housing and various difficult conditions were falling ill, and in some cases dying at higher rates than anybody. And we sort of mapped the COVID case data to our language map and saw a very direct correlation that there was also a linguistic side to this, that there was, in the midst of the so-called infodemic of all the sort of fake news and other, you know, just swirl of information, that there was just, people were not getting the timely, crucial information in their languages. And of course, this was a huge, in some ways, unprecedented public health challenge, but it was also a linguistic crisis in some ways. And so we kind of, I mean, we threw ourselves into that work as well, and so did so many of the communities and language activists. And it kind of, new connections between language and health, language and livelihood, I think, began to emerge. I mean, it on the positive side, it did mean that there were more messages, I think, in different languages about COVID than really have ever existed for any single event in the world, which is extraordinary to think about. And, you know, it's just a testament to, I think, you know, linguists and language activists and speakers kind of working together. And of course, in some cases, it was just, you know, there was one message that was made, there was one poster that was translated. That's still significant, you know, if it was never, had never been done for that language before, a public health message. But it's not a substitute for the, you know, having a sort of a continual flow of timely information from a trusted messenger in the right kind of channels for a community. So I guess, yeah, what has kind of been extraordinary for me to watch, even just as I've been, you know, as I wrote the book, is the way that that these issues are kind of morphing and changing, and the connections between, you know, what I thought initially was a book about, you know, extraordinary linguistic diversity and language endangerment in cities, also has become a book about immigration and public health and language justice, which is an emergent field itself.
Thank you for telling us that. That's really interesting to hear, given how close, obviously, you are to all of this. As a final question, I wonder if I can get your perspective on another big picture topic, but not about you this time, about perhaps everyone else. What do you hope people take away from this book? And are there ways for people maybe listening or reading the book to get involved?
I hope that Language City brings both languages and cities kind of closer within earshot to people. I know that, you know, language, unlike perhaps, you know, food or dress or music, is not as immediately kind of accessible. One can hear, you know, languages one's not familiar with around, but without any context, it's hard, or without translation, it's hard to kind of make much of it. But I hope that people will recognize that the linguistic diversity of all the spaces that they're moving through, and perhaps even if it's not just, you know, immediately publicly present to them, is much deeper than they realize, and that cities are in kind of an extraordinary position today in terms of, you know, the future of languages, and that there is a role that I think all of us can play there. And that, you know, extends from both the sort of the personal, learn a language, be curious about the languages around you, of course, not in a, you know, in a nice way, but be sort of alert to that, support, certainly, you know, it's to buy the book, to support the Endangered Language Alliance. And, you know, there are other efforts as well, even if they're not sort of urban focused, but there's sort of, this is really a small world only of efforts around linguistic diversity compared to biodiversity, for instance, where there are huge organizations and, you know, a lot of great work. But this is a very nascent kind of field, even within linguistics. This is just a small piece of the, at the moment. I hope it will grow. You know, there's so much interest I see from students, from young people, but so few avenues, and really so little in terms of resources, from majority language speakers, from governments and so on, for, you know, these non-official, non-national languages. So, you know, I think, yeah, beginning with people's own curiosity, your own sort of learning, your own thinking, seeing this as, you know, a lens, language as a lens onto so many different issues in the humanities and the social sciences, and, you know, questions of immigration and diversity, not just to think about sort of all the other familiar forms, but to think about linguistic diversity, and to build it into kind of what you do.
Well, one place to start with that is, of course, to read the book we've been discussing. Again, that is titled Language City, The Fight to Preserve Endangered Mother Tongues in New York. Ross, thank you so much for being with us to tell us about the book and all the work you're doing.
Thank you so much, Miranda.